Girls' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. We hear a little rain today. I hope it's nice where you are, wherever that is.
It was rain and then sun, and now it's cloudy again. And
yeah,
a summer rain is really quite nice.
Yes,
I agree.
And I need it.
Now, we have someone who has spent some time in Iowa with us today. Quite a bit of time in Iowa.
Yeah.
Born here.
Fairfield.
That's true. I've lived in Fairfield for about 4 years, but I was born in Davenport, so I was in my blood.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to we'll get a little more into that as we go. Mom, do you want to introduce Lawrence Iyer today?
Yes, I will. He was born in Iowa, as he said, in Davenport along the Mississippi River, and he holds a BA from Yale in American Studies. He has taught history and coached tennis for 30 years at Maharishi School in Fairfield, Iowa, and the United States Professional Tennis Association named him National High School Coach of the Year in 2009. That's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Haiku Country is a book of haiku, and he's also the author of Heartland Haiku. So there's...
That's right. Both books launched within 4 months of each other, December 2019 for Heartland Haiku, and then you're right, Haiku Country most recently in April of this year.
And I have Haiku Country, and I think, Mom, do you have Heartland Haiku?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So...
All right. Thank you.
Great. So let's just start. Why haiku?
I learned haiku in third grade in Moline, Illinois. I was born in Davenport, but I grew up on the other side of the river in the Quad Cities. My whole family were great-grandpa farmed, and then grandpa and dad worked for John Deere. I went to John Deere Junior High there, but before, when I was in third grade, our teacher taught us haiku. And all of us thought it was so great to have something that short that we could call poetry. So 3 lines, 5 syllables, 7 syllables, 5 syllables was workable even for a third grader. We enjoyed it at the time. And truthfully, I went another half century without writing another one, though. In about 2005, I was tennis director at a camp. I've been there 20 years. It would be 21 years this summer, except for coronavirus rescheduling a lot of things in people's lives, but they needed a little bit of an inspiration for an Olympics within the camp to make sure that all our enthusiastic campers remained enthusiastic toward everyone, whether they're on the blue team or the green team. And so they asked me to say something, and I thought, well, I think I'll write a haiku. So I wrote a piece haiku. It's actually in Haiku Country. And that was the first one in 50 years, as I said. And I didn't write any more until 2017, just for the fun of it, really. It became a hobby, which by now is certainly a habit. And I hope it's a healthy habit, but it's certainly a habit that is with me. Since about October of 2017, it's been pretty much nonstop writing haiku.
So you write every day?
I really do. They'll come in spurts, but it's a rare day that I don't write one down somewhere. I post some on social media, on Facebook and on Instagram and Twitter. But sometimes I just write them and, file them away. I read about Richard Wright, the famous author of Native Son, who at the end of his career as a novelist actually wrote 4,000 haiku. Which was an astonishing number to many people, including myself. But I realize now I'm at least a third of the way there, on toward half the way there, in writing haiku in these past 2.5 years. So it does become a habit. I do hope it's healthy. It's really charming to be able to say something in only 17 syllables. At the same time, it's incredibly challenging because it's absolutely unforgiving in the format. You can't bend it. It's 5, 7, 5, whether that last syllable squeezes in or not. So it is a challenge without any question. But I like challenge. I think that's probably the tie-in with tennis, playing and coaching. that I like challenge. And I certainly like words, and I love nature. My wife and I live out here about 7 or 8 miles northwest of Fairfield, and it's inspiring. I agree with you about summer rains. They deserve their own haiku.
There you go.
And I'm sure you'll write it.
I suppose you got me thinking already.
Yeah. So can you share that first one that you wrote for the tennis camp? Would you share that with us?
Sure. Yes, it's in haiku country, and it, again, is meant for the campers. And this is a repeat after me haiku, because we do it in an event where all the campers and their counselors are gathered together before we begin playing all the sports in this Olympics called Spirit Day. So can you be the campers for just a minute, and we'll do it kind of like it would be a camp. Repeat after me.
Okay.
Okay. Peace begins within.
Peace begins within.
Peace moves from my team to ours.
Peace moves from my team to ours.
Peace unites us all.
Peace unites us all. How'd I do?
That's the haiku. You did great. I think both the blue and green teams are going to be vying to get you on their squad.
Yeah, not to play tennis, though, that's for sure.
Okay. Good luck.
Volleyball, maybe, but not tennis.
Good for you. Oh, that's good. So that's how it began, if I have to trace it back, after half a century. And, again, there's a 12-year hiatus. I was coaching college tennis for a while. I was here 25 years at Maharishi School coaching the high school team. And then I coached at Grinnell College here in Iowa and at Knox College in Galesburg, which was a full circle experience because my great-grandfather, who farmed very near Galesburg and is buried very near Galesburg. So I went back to my family roots physically. And as soon as I retired ostensibly from Knox, we moved out here to this cottage. And ever since I've been writing haiku. So I'm not sure. You all wonder why things happen, but it certainly has been a fun and inspiring opportunity to write haikus ever since October 2017.
Well, we have a family connection with Grinnell, right, Mom?
Yeah. Oh. Right.
Yeah. Was it your father or your grandfather who went there?
Both.
Both.
They both went there.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Wonderful. Well, you know, in that wonderful movie Lincoln, Steven Spielberg was the director for. They do a roll call vote in the House of Representatives to really decide if there will be an abolition of slavery, 13th Amendment. And in the middle of that scene, in the roll call, they say, Josiah Grinnell, and he says, aye. So it's very powerfully the Grinnell history of abolitionism and of support for the ending of slavery was depicted in that movie. So if you get to revisit that film, I'm sure you'll hear the word Grinnell.
Wow. Well, you know, our roots in Iowa go back pretty far. On Mom's side of the family, both of her parents' families came to Iowa in probably the 1800s. Yeah, and on her father's side, her great great grandfather, or not exactly sure how many greats, was a judge in Central Iowa.
Uh-huh.
And was your great grandfather. Okay. And he was, we have a clipping, a newspaper clipping, where he's being referred to as the only honest judge in Iowa.
Oh, my goodness. Well, certainly a compliment, but also a comment on the quality of things at the time.
And
I like to say sometime. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, and his wife, I believe, was the one who, or his mother? His mother ran a station on the Underground Railroad.
Oh, yes. You know, there's a wonderful 8-part local history series, a Fairfield history series of films that are directed by Dick DeAngelis. I'm the history research guy. I needed a history nerd to make sure that what we were doing was not history and not just story. And so we're on our fourth film now. It's been just a fantastic learning opportunity. And our second film had a large section about the Underground Railroad right here in Jefferson County. So certainly that's inspiring to know your family is part of that.
Right. Although we weren't here. We were in Jasper County up in central Iowa.
Okay.
Yeah. So not too far from Grinnell, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
I think she was in Missouri, though, as I recall.
Oh.
I thought it was Lamb's Grove. I thought she was in Lamb's Grove. We'll have to look it up. Look up the...
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Lamb's Grove is,
you know, I kind
of, is east of...
I kind of like to say that I'm the justice of the peace in haiku country, and it's a great job. I really do enjoy the work of creating haiku for a place that isn't limited by geography. You know, it's everywhere folks love life simple. Is a place that we could call haiku country. And it might sound country, you know, it could be three chords and the truth kind of haiku, or it could be Yoda sounding haiku. And both those kinds and many more are in my book so far.
Wow. There's quite a few individual verses I'm going to ask you about.
But, oh, okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
But before we get there, I would like to remind our listeners that this is Writers' Voices, and we're speaking with Lawrence Iyer, author of Haiku Country and Heartland Haiku. How many verses are in each of these books?
Between 250 and 300 in each one.
And
so I guess, 500.
And how do you decide what to put in, what to leave out, and what order? And all of those things.
It's a great question. I realize that ideally, haiku is self-standing. You know, it's just three lines and it has its own life. But I also know that they're on pages and they're on facing pages in some ways. And so I try to arrange, though, under different themes and with different kind of sequences. Haiku that match with each other or lead into each other or resonate with each other so that there are echoes from haiku to haiku, you might say. It's an experiment that is ongoing. And, you know, I chose in both books to do four haiku per page and then, you know, two facing pages. And it is a work in progress. In the very first book, I was really attempting to introduce characters. And by characters, I include people. But also rivers and eagles and plants as part of the world of Heartland Haiku. And they were ricocheting off each other all the way through the book. Mm. So still experimenting with it, and I think it may be different each time given what the content of each individual haiku might be.
Now, every so often in this one, in Haiku Country, there's a page that has two or three on a page. Is that supposed to signify the end of a section?
Yes, yeah, really, that's fair to say, that there is an end of a theme, you might say, in the beginning of a new one. And that's as much as of a signal as I generally would do. Sometimes there's an unstated, an empty space on purpose. Because silence is what is within haiku and between haiku and among haiku. It's the shared value that underlies all poetry, certainly, and all language. And sometimes, every once in a while, I'll have an empty space as a reminder that silence is the basis of sound and all the words that we speak and read.
You know, you talked about first learning haiku in third grade, and I don't remember exactly what grade I learned it in, but I do remember writing haiku in elementary school and really liking it. And I think a lot of kids really like it. Mom, did you, English teacher, did you teach haiku at all?
No, I didn't. Well, I had junior high and high school.
Right.
But I wish I had, because I think it's just great. I mean, I'm just wondering, how old is this? Is this an ancient technique?
Yes, ma'am. I mean, originally from Japan, and, you know, people trace it back to several centuries. And there are rules, which I, both in ignorance and in cheerful stumbling about, break without really feeling much compunction. I really incorporated really only the three lines in 575. I had, how do I say it nicely? I had a professor, a friend, and still a friend, who said to me, with nose a little bit in the air, that this really isn't haiku, at least more than a one-fourth or one-third of the time, given the themes that I introduce and given my the style, that it's really, it's called Senryu, or Senryu, S-E-N-R-Y-U would be our way of writing it in English. And those allow for a lot more thematic possibilities and a lot more rhythmic variation than might be found in classical Japanese haiku. And I respect immensely the people who can stay within that additional set of constraints. I just couldn't. And it's not how I learned. I mean, I can't claim I ever studied to be on third grade. And so I just chose the form both for simplicity and for the challenge of trying to say something worthwhile in only 17 syllables.
Well, what are some of those additional rules?
Well, in classical haiku, there would be about nature themes only, and in season. And there are also rules that don't translate as easily to English because they have to do with accents and the ending of thought on each line. Mm. And that there might be a twist, a surprise at the end. Now, that I've certainly, in the third line, many times I've done the punchline, you might say, or the surprise, the twist, the O. Henry moment, you know, where something unexpected comes in that third line. So that all those are part of the classical tradition, and as much as I've gathered hearing other people talk about it, truthfully, I've not been a student of it in a little bit now anyway, by design, so I can just use my 575. There's in haiku country, I think you probably saw the page there, Monica Rice, saying, if 575 patrols this space, we can say whatever pleases. And that pretty much has been my operating principle. I certainly keep it family channel appropriate, but any manner of topics and you know, all possibilities for rhythms, carryover lines, not always ending at the end of each line, a thought or feeling, painting a picture. There's more of a still life quality, if I can say it, with minimalist action in Japanese classical haiku. And that's less so here. This is very much an American set of poems. In terms of the 21st century dynamic spillover, I said on the very first poem of the introduction of Heartland Haiku that in these Twitter times, haiku length may match people's full attention span. I've had so many people who are social media veterans and perhaps addicts admit quite freely that they're able to, they like the haiku because they don't last very long. You know? And I even wrote a haiku about it. I said, you know, even a really bad haiku has one great thing about it. It's only three lines.
Ah.
So I hope there aren't very many bad ones. But there is a virtue in this fast-paced time to having, you know, its brevity built in. And haiku does that.
Have you been tempted to try other forms of poetry? Have you attempted any?
My hat is off to everyone who can. I'm amazed at the length of poems. I love Shakespeare. I studied Shakespeare at Yale. Took a whole year course, three mornings a week at 8 in the morning. Never missed one. Why? It was Shakespeare. I loved it. And, you know, classical English poets. I looked at Robert Penn Warren, American poet, Robert Frost, Stephen Crane earlier. Many, many wonderful poets over time. And I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they've sustained their thought and their feeling and their images. I like aphorism. I like the proverbs in the scriptures of the world religions. I like the short, to the point headlines that encapsulate a lot of material. In a way, I suppose that's another draw of haiku. I mentioned one other influence, which is a Burma Shave. Remember those Burma Shave signs on Midwestern highways back in the 50s before the interstate? They were brief. They were snappy. Mm-hmm. They had cadence, and they always had a kick at the ending.
Yeah,
I realized as I write these that there's an extent to which that has been seeping in to my haiku, acknowledging all the above. My hat's off to anyone who can write poetry at length. Right now, I know country songs. A lot of country songs have what could be considered hooks. You know, the initial lines are haiku. And there are rock and roll songs that are haiku. The Beatles, "She Came In Through the Bathroom Window, Protected by a Silver Spoon." That's a haiku. When the Beach Boys wrote "Be True to Your School," it's "Be true to your school, just like you would to your girl. Let your colors fly." That's haiku. So it shows up without our perhaps recognizing the form more often than we might think. And so I know that a lot of songwriters will do like a double-decker stacked haiku for their verses. Actually, that shows up in country music quite a bit. So it's there. It's just not called haiku, but the rhythms, you know, some speculate that we have a built-in readiness for that 5-7-5. I don't know. I just like the songs.
Lawrence, when and how did you recognize that those songs had, that those lyrics, the rhythm was haiku?
I think just counting. My wife, it's always embarrassing, you know, Lori points out to me sometimes, someone's drumming on the kitchen counter, someone's drumming on the steering wheel of the car, someone's drumming on his quadriceps as we're walking. It's, I'm counting. I realize that. I played drums early on in grade school, actually, and I realized the rhythm has certainly seeped into my bloodstream by now of doing haiku and deciding what is 5 and 7 and what's 5. And I think I heard the songs and, wait a minute, that's a haiku. You know, I think it was going backward from knowing a little bit more about haiku from having tried to write some. And then hearing the songs and realizing that the rhythm fit the pattern.
So that's not well known, that those songs are
not haiku. Really. I think we could dig without, actually that whole song, virtually that whole song by the Beatles is a series of haiku. They had to cheat only once, you know, to take out a vowel to make a contraction that didn't quite fit. But otherwise, it's quite remarkable. So if you listen to it next time, you're hooked now. You'll have to hear and count.
So they must have been, it must have been intentional on their part then.
I think in their case, they must have known. Now, I don't know everybody who writes music, you know, some begin with the melody, some begin with the rhythm, some begin with the lyrics themselves and then find both the musical rhythm and the melody to match. I don't know how they went about creating those songs, either group. I'd be delighted to find out. To see if it went from lyrics first to the melody and the arrangement, or if it went backwards. I don't know which. That would be really fun to find out.
Lawrence, you were talking about country songs, and I had noted this one haiku in Haiku Country. Believe it or not, Roy Rogers' Happy Trails was meant to close Woodstock. All right, tell me about that.
Okay, it's not a haiku story, but I'm happy to tell it. It was at the end of Woodstock. It was before the rains came, and Jimi Hendrix ended up, you know, playing Waking People Up in the final morning with his just incendiary, incredible version of Star Spangled Banner. It was originally thought that Roy Rogers was going to come on stage and sing Happy Trails to You as the final song, and as 500,000 people at this city that assembled and was going just to disassemble, was going to come to an end. And it didn't work out. It didn't work out that he could do that. And that's, the intention was there from the very start, though, that Happy Trails to You would be how they sent him back home.
I'm kind of surprised that Roy Rogers wanted to participate in that.
Well, it may have been, there are various stories about it, and one of them says that he was the reason it didn't happen. But I can't prove it.
He backed out of it, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the stories. It's murky, as much of Woodstock lore is.
Yeah. Oh, that was quite a time. Oh, my goodness.
Yes, ma'am.
So, Mom, what are some of the verses that that spoke to you from...
I'll tell you, I started to read this, and then it just gets better and better. I mean, you know, it really does. Silence is sometimes the most respectful response we can offer. We all can offer. I mean, you know, you read these, and you think, yeah, that's exactly right. No.
Thank you.
Now, when I was in college, I don't know who wrote this, but I had read it somewhere, and so I wrote a paper on it, and my professor didn't like it. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Oh, no.
But the person who wrote this said, a poem should not mean, but be.
Yes.
And to me, yes, that sounded really, you know, really good.
Thank you. To have that associated with that statement, I hope the poem has a life of its own and has a message for life that is on the feeling level, beneath meaning, beneath what our minds, what our intellects may think about it, that it is a natural response. Often the most compassionate way we can respond to an event is with supportive silence. I'm delighted that you saw that in that poem.
And then there's, I had made a whole bunch of notes, but it just seemed like every page that I turned, there was something on there that, you know, I really liked. Bridging opposites is the job of love. Our hearts span many canyons. We harvest heartland's best crop when we plant seeds of peace within us all. And we can sure use that right now, can't we?
Yes, ma'am. And I do agree that it is peace begins within, as the old Campai crew said, and that the best crop that can be planted in the heartland being not only the middle of America, you know, the Mississippi River and all its tributaries, but the heartland inside us. And so, you know, mm-hmm. that the title was and the use of that phrase, it shows up so many times in the book. Has to do with that, the inner value of our heart being responsible and being more powerful than so many features of the surface of life that may be proclaimed a lot more loudly. What carries the day is that peace in our own hearts. I'm delighted that you've noticed these. Thank you.
Like I said, every page that I turned, I thought, oh gosh, this just gets better and better.
and some of the haiku verses are very serious and very kind of evoking wisdom. And then there's some that are lighter and like this is one of my favorites. Save on Christmas gifts. Talk politics at your feast on Thanksgiving Day.
That pretty much assures a smaller Christmas list for anymore. I like jokes. I love jokes. I sang in the Whiffenpoof singing group at Yale, and it's the America's oldest collegiate a cappella group. And my job, our fun was to sing, but in each concert they would have one joke, only one. And so they made me the oldest. It's fancy sounding, but it's just the joke teller. And so I've always loved jokes, and it occurred to me maybe it's possible to do 17 syllable jokes. So you're quite right. I put a lot of those in there with the hope that someone will laugh and at least lighten the load of the day. You know, laughter has a therapeutic value. The doctors have shown us again and again. And to the extent that there can be a little bit of a lift to people's hearts, even from reading, you know, three lines, then so much the better. I feel like that's mission accomplished. Maybe get them to think a little bit. Maybe get them to laugh a little bit. Maybe let them feel inspired to take a closer look at things in nature. All of the above would be among my hopes for when people read my poems.
Well, isn't there a verse in here about laughter as medicine?
Yes, there is. It was easier. It was one of the hard ones. I talk about how certain haiku are very hard, like whittling, you know, a large branch with bark on it down to small sticks. That was one of those. Sometimes haiku just present themselves, all three lines, 5, 7, 5. Here it is. Wow, it all fit. Other times it's in the middle, you know, play with it a while, come back to it, and then it kind of feel like it's a little more agreeable. And then other times it's just, I know what I want to say and I know what I feel, but it takes forever whittling away. And that was one of them.
And can you read what you ended up with? It's on page 59.
Well, I was going to ask you if you found it. It paid,
yes.
Yeah, 59.
59.
Thank you. That's right. Thank you. Seriously, folks, if laughter helps health, the joke is in us, not on.
And so that's one of the ones that has the twist at the end, too.
That's right. That we have kind of built into us a receptivity to humor. There's like a humor gene, a joke gene, you might say, inside us. We like the incongruities of life. I certainly do. And I notice that people don't mind. There's a delight in having an expectation, like a bubble, just punctured, as long as it's not injurious. And that's really what humor does. It takes our minds in a different direction. You know, magicians always use visual misdirection. I suppose even in a haiku, we can have some mental misdirection. There's an expectation, there's a familiar sounding phrase, and all of a sudden it comes out differently at the end. And if that's some of the things you notice, I'm delighted.
I like the next one on that page, too.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, here we go. I do love apple pie. By the way, I'm a late October child, so starting after age 9, I never had cake on my birthday. I always had apple pie. It was self-evident that anyone should really think that apple pie was vastly superior to cake. That was my experience at a young age. So here's that haiku. It's counting syllables sure beats counting calories. Pass the apple pie.
And there's one a couple pages later that I got a kick out of. Folks who can't decide to fish or cut bait live in a big can of worms.
Well, we all either have been ourselves or know someone or many people who have trouble deciding, and even, you know, what to buy at the store, you know, how much gas to get, what to wear today, whatever it is. And so it is living in a can of worms.
Yeah.
If we can't fish or cut bait.
Now, I noticed normally there's not rhyme in haiku, but the one right after that on page 62, there's one that does have some rhyme to it.
Yes, no, I'll tell you this one. I'm so delighted. This actually comes, it's a modification, a haiku version of one of those famous Burma shave signs, which itself was a celebration of Longfellow's Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. So, you know,
okay.
Midnight Ride of Paul Revere, 1775. Longfellow wrote his poem, 1860 or 61. And in the 1950s, Burmishay put it on one of their signs. And so I tried to find a way to put it into haiku form. So hardly a driver now alive who passed on hills at 75. that was one of their cautionary. They began in the late 50s. To caution people who wanted to drive fast. The interstate highways were starting to pop up, and on two-lane country roads, it just wasn't safe. And so that was their cautionary Burmishave sequence.
And
but
what
that
was
goes
the,
all the way back.
Yeah, tell us what the poem was. What did it actually say on Burmishave, and then what was the poem that came from?
The Burmishave I'd have to look up, but it's a "Gather on, my children, and you shall hear the midnight ride of Paul Revere." So it was the 18th of April in 75, and hardly is a man alive to tell of it this day.
Ah.
And so that was Longfellow in 1860 writing about it, and indeed, hardly anyone was alive who remembered that.
Right.
So, yeah, that's where that came. I was so delighted that you noticed that. It's fun as a history teacher myself, you know, for over 30 years, to throw one in that has something to do with not just the history of the United States, but also the history of poems in the United States. So that one did it, and with the tip of the hat to Burma Shave for making it happen.
Oh, gosh. Well, I like this. I like this one, I think, is on page 55. Nana taught us that angels hide inside pockets to watch over us. Our hidden helpers watch and wait for us to sing them into action.
Yes, that's two in a row. Put haiku back to back, having really a flow, I hope, one into the other. Our Nana was my Swedish grandmother, Florence Carlson, before she became Florence Fire. And her father was the farmer who came from Sweden and farmed near Galesburg. And she always would, whenever we were going to leave, in fact, when I went off to Yale, the last thing she did before I walked out of my visit to her that day was to put something in my pocket, nothing that I could see, but it was the angel. And I knew what it stood for. And so our Nana loved us, and she always said that those angels would be our helpers. And
That's great. I thought this would appeal to children, you know? And that's...
Yes. If it's okay for my mentioning, I thank you for bringing that up. I've taught writing haiku to third graders and fourth graders, and to even to some second graders. You know, it's a little tricky for those second graders. It works for third better, and I think it's just developmentally. One, customs of language use are more absorbed by them, and vocabularies are expanded. But third, fourth, fifth graders, I've done it two or three times, and it's been a delight to see them run with it, to have fun with all the possibilities that are there, including their family lives, what they see in nature, what they experience in school. The whole world kind of opens up, and this is just a simple key that lets them begin to express themselves in ways that sharpen their perception. They start looking for things and then deciding what it means to them or what it feels like to them. So it's been fun, and I look forward to doing more of that when school's back in session. We're pretty much zoomed out. I imagine you folks, everybody is experiencing that. We've done, you know, we conducted school all the way from mid-March to the end of the school year and had our graduation just last week, and we zoomed the whole thing. And it does work, but it's not as much fun as being with the kids. And, you know, the kids feel the same, even though, you know, Mr. Iyer gave us homework and so on. They'd rather be with us, and we'd certainly rather be with them.
So you're still teaching?
Yes. You know, interestingly, I came back, you know, thinking, as I said, that I was retired. and so
good luck
happens,
with that.
Exactly right. And it was by choice. Someone had a maternity leave, and they said, hey, could you help out with our history class? I said, sure. And then, you know, just stayed on. So I'm teaching American history, U.S. history. I taught advanced placement, U.S. history this year. Also taught the world religions course to the seniors in our school that I taught for many years. I taught it for 15 years at the local college at Marist University from 1981 up through 95. So it's been a great homecoming. I'm also coaching the girls tennis team that I founded 30 years ago. I coached them for 5 years along with the boys team that I coached 25 years. Here in Iowa, the seasons for boys and girls tennis in high school are the same, and it's really almost the only state in the country. It's very challenging when all the courts are in use and needing to be in use by two sets of teams in every school. So it would be a most schools separate by season, one in the fall, one in the spring. So after 5 years, I had recruited my wife, Lori, who coached the girls the next 20 years. And so after coming back from my 5 or 6 years of college coaching, I've come back. We have a boys coach, Steve Briggs, who's doing a terrific job. And so I came back to start up the girls program again. And I'm having just a terrific time. It's reached the stage where old enough that I am teaching and soon to be coaching in the high school level, kids of kids, children of people I've already taught and coached.
Oh, boy.
So
honorary
grandparent status out there on the court and in the classroom. Happy to do it. It's a delight. It really is a delight.
It's pretty amazing how many talented tennis players we've had here in Fairfield, and I'm sure that you have had a lot to do with that. I mean, we had one of your students went on to play professionally, I believe.
Well, Tyler Cleveland won three state championships in singles here and went on to play number one singles and number one doubles for four consecutive years at the University of Iowa. He's in the Athletics Hall of Fame, the only two-time Big Ten Player of the Year. And you're right, after working a desk job for a few years, he kind of kicked himself and said, hey, I should see how far I can go in this tennis. And by then, he'd been out of the game long enough that it took quite a lot of energy to get back in. But he went all the way from over 1,650 in the world up to the top 300. He had wins over people that we've seen play on TV. So Tyler's a great guy and a great player, and we're happy that he's back in Fairfield. He's actually working with some of the kids who are here in town, the next generation coming up.
And I have a very talented young lady living upstairs from me who I believe has got some real future in tennis. Rhea, do you know Rhea?
Oh, yes, yes. She's doing a great job. DeArmond Briggs and Steve Briggs are two of the teachers who've been here all along. We're from rival towns, you know, Moline, Illinois, and Rock Island, Illinois. My mom was a Rock Island girl. My dad was a Moline boy, and you didn't talk. It was like Tale of Two Cities. You know, we joke about it now, but back in the day, back, you know, 70 years ago, it was only recently that they agreed that a certain street would have the same number on it, because by golly, in Rock Island, it's 18th Avenue. And in Moline is 23rd, so you just deal with it. You know, that was how it went. Now it's a symbol of the peace that is, emerging in the Quad Cities that is now called Avenue of the Cities. It sounds a little bit grand, but at least they agreed on it. So I'm delighted.
Good choice.
I'm delighted.
That's a good choice, yeah.
It is, yeah. I mean, everybody can get behind that one. So Steve and Jarman are from Rock Island High School, and I was from Moline. And my brother Pat, who's 4 years younger, played against the Briggs brothers. I was older enough that I didn't, which was fortunate because Jarman was so good. He beat Jimmy Connors, the Hall of Fame, International Hall of Fame player, when they were both age 12.
Wow.
So all of us, they received far more Division I offers than I did. I got an offer from Illinois State to play tennis there, but I got the academic scholarship offer at Yale, and there was no way I was going to turn it down. I signed as fast as I could in hopes that they wouldn't change their mind. You know,
play tennis at Yale?
I did, but I also stopped playing so that I have a chance to be in the Whiffen Proofs. To me, my decision was, well, I hope tennis would be there. It has been. I've been a teaching pro, I've been teaching tennis for decades and coaching, you know, almost that whole time as well. So it's worked out, and my 50th college reunion was meant to be last month. And the Whiffen Proofs were all getting in shape locally and ready to sing, put on a wonderful concert for our classmates. But, of course, it was postponed, and it looks like it'll be a year from now. So we put out albums. We had really a life kind of like you might imagine in Great Gatsby, and all for free. You know, we just sang for our supper wherever we went. We were in Bermuda for 2 weeks at the Castle Harbor Hotel, where President Nixon and then Prime Minister Heath of England had met for their summit just before that. We got to go so many places and sing for people. I noticed that people love the song no matter what their social standing and how much or how little they have to call, you know, their assets materially. And it was a joy. And we've been friends ever since and have sung in reunions every 5 years. And whenever we can get together in twos and threes, we've been doing that for half a century now. And we'll go until our voices become silent.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Lawrence Iyer, author of Haiku Country and Heartland Haiku. Lawrence, would you tell us the story behind this one? I drop the school drum and promptly get encouraged to join the boys' choir.
Okay, that was a fork in the road as I look back on my young life. That was about age 10, and the Garfield School, where I had learned haiku a year before that, had a school band, and they had a brand new snare drum, and I just loved playing on it. And I dropped it. It broke. And the band director was married to my Sunday school teacher, and so he had to be on good behavior. But I knew he was scheming. And so the best he could muster in terms of politeness was an invitation that I should try out for the Moline Boys Choir. Well, the rest is history. You know, the Moline Boys Choir led to the other choirs in town, at school, and in churches. And it led to singing at Yale and touring the world as a member of the Whiffen Poofs. Sorry to Mr. Youngdahl. I'm sorry, sir. But I'm not sorry that that drum was broken when it was, because I started singing as a result.
Oh, wow.
Did you ever let him know what
influence
he had?
I didn't get the opportunity to speak to him directly, but to his wife I did.
Oh.
She was my teacher in junior year in high school. And so I did get to thank her.
All right, here's another one that I really want to know the story behind.
Sure.
Steel girders strike road, split ahead of speeding car, sparing driver's life.
Yeah, that's one of those headline haiku. I write them sometimes. This is a disaster waiting to happen. I was driving in 1981 from Minneapolis. In St. Paul, I just finished my master's degree at Luther Seminary in New Testament Studies. And had chosen not to get ordained. I had so many friends who weren't from my faith background who, again and again and again over a 15 or 20-year period, the people I love so much who came into my life were not Lutheran and not even Christian. They were Buddhist. They were Jewish. They were from other traditions. And so I decided I will do my MA and I will be able to be a teacher, but I don't want to be a minister and wear that collar. I would have felt it personally. Confining. And so I drove down here to Iowa. I was driving to Iowa, and it was on Interstate 35, and I was doing near Albert Lea, where they have long, slow upgrades, long, slow hill. And there was a semi, and they hadn't fastened their girders, I guess, adequately. And they came right off the back of this speeding truck, headed right toward me. I was in a little Honda that didn't weigh more than, you know, a toy, it feels like nowadays. And I realized that I was probably going to die. I didn't have any room or time to swerve. And I said a prayer, maybe the thought of a prayer, because I didn't even have time to say it. And the girder split. So I've always been grateful to God for that moment.
So split in meaning that they went towards the side and you drove like up
yes,
the middle
it was like a V. It's like an inverted V that I was able to drive up the middle of.
Wow.
And they just spread past me left and right at that moment.
Oh, my gosh.
And from instant death, you know, definite death, to still being alive and grateful and wanting to say so half a century later.
Wow. I mean, did you still, was your car damaged? Was there still...
No, it didn't touch it. I mean, to this day, I don't know how they hit the ground and went out in a V, you know.
Oh,
that's
I think
I can
that
say.
Was
inverted V.
I think that was those angels in your pocket.
Well, you know, right? That's so nice. My Nana is smiling as you say that. My Nana is smiling as you say that.
No, I'm
that's
very
cute.
Big on angels. Believe me.
Well,
she is.
Well, good for you, because though they were sometimes considered fanciful, I experience them very directly, the way you're describing it. Often, you know, quietly, sometimes utterly silently. Not loud ever, but very active for sure. And I realize that a lot of us are making them work overtime, and I wish that weren't so.
Oh, golly.
You know, we should have done this at the beginning, but you're about the author on the inside of the back cover is in haiku also.
Yes.
And, Mom, do you want to read that?
Sure.
Okay. Lawrence Iyer taught and coached happily for decades, deep in the heartland. Then haiku started to strike like sneezing fits in hay fever season. An effective cure for chronic haiku habits has yet to be found.
And in my book, under about the author, it says, born in Iowa, along the Mississippi, where the steamboats push. Great-grandfather farmed, grandpa and dad worked for deer. I teach what I've learned. Yale's yes, plus 50, years back home, ripened me to write Heartland Haiku.
Well, thank you for reading both. It's certainly true. I guess I'll start with the mirror one, Monica, if that's okay, that I had no thought to be a writer. I mean, I wrote articles about tennis. I certainly wrote all the academic papers, you know, as part of our training. And I made videos, instructional videos for tennis over the years. And so I had no ambition to be a writer, but I realized that a half century after college of really building up experience to sift through and sort through and maybe find something worthwhile to say or try to was really kind of the building up of a fund of possibility, which is expressing itself in this very simple 5-7-5 framework. It's very much true earlier on of the Mississippi River has a legendary status among children. The children's games of kids in the heartland who live near the river often reflect the father of waters of the Mississippi. And so that phrase about where the steamboats push, we used to have a rope jumping game in Moline that would be down the Mississippi, the mighty Mississippi, where the steamboats push. It would be in the long rope where one child would be under that rope and then jump out and another child jump in where the steamboats push. We wouldn't physically push someone out, but that was a signal for one to leave and one to jump in. And that's why I included that, because it really settles deep down. Those rhythms stay with you a whole lifetime, even from childhood with that rope jumping. So that was part of the legend of Mississippi. The coaching that I did before, I absolutely enjoyed. I absolutely enjoyed classroom teaching. I enjoyed teaching tennis. Thousands. I've taught well over 15,000 people how to play tennis. And this haiku really was kind of like a little bit of an allergy. That's why I said that it was like the sneezing fit that you can't figure out how to get rid of them. So the only way for me to get rid of it is to write them. And so ever since I began, which is now 2.5 years ago, a little more than that, that's the cure. I guess the cure is feeding the addiction, at least in this case. They present themselves. They sometimes just in seed form, sometimes whole cloth. I think I mentioned one that some haiku arrive simply with a stork, and others require longer labor. Both are true. I experience both. So I welcome both, and I don't mind wrestling with the rhythm sometimes. I sometimes leave it and come back. I think that's what many writers report, that they have to just come back to something that isn't coming out the way they would hope their feelings to be conveyed. And I have that experience, but I have again and again so many times. It just presents itself, and it'd be like a 5-minute process. Here's another one. Here's another one. And it's a delight. If people, I'm thrilled that anyone finds value. I certainly find value. I realize that we write them to please ourselves if no one reads them, because I have more that no one has read except I wrote them and they're in my files. And I'm delighted that people have read any at all. And I thank you both, because you've chosen ones I haven't really been asked to speak about before.
We're almost out of time, Lawrence, but I did want to ask about the publishing process with these two books. Now, you've published with First World Publishing, and it's been a while, but we've had Rodney Charles on the show before talking about how that publishing company works. Do you want to fill us in a little bit on that?
Yeah, Rodney Charles, bless his heart, has been a great guy. One, he was willing to listen to a 70-year-old pitch an idea for a poetic form that was, by his admission, not really accustomed for him. He knew what haiku were, but he, you know, it wasn't something he published before. And who is this guy? I know him from tennis, but why is he giving me a manuscript of haiku? So I thank Roddy for taking taking a chance on me. He had every reason demographically to think it was a long shot. And I'm so delighted because, you know, as we do the launches for these both books, Heartland Haiku launched in December at number 4 for haiku on Amazon. It went up from number 700 plus to number 4 on launch day. And likewise with Haiku Country, it went from nowhere to number 5 on launch day. So I'm grateful for the support he has given and the support that friends at it isn't all my brother and who's been buying box after box of these. It's friends from college and friends from high school, friends from here in Iowa, fellow umpires, you know, for the Big Ten. I've been a Big Ten college tennis umpire for well over 20 years. And, you know, so they're just wonderful, good-hearted people who've responded in a very encouraging way to the launch of these books. I haven't stopped writing. I realize there are going to be more at some point. I'd like to be able actually to sign this book and maybe talk about it at bookstores. And, of course, right now there's a hiatus for that, except on Zoom. And I'd rather, much rather, be in person. So I'm grateful to you for giving me a chance to talk with you. And some people will hear, you know, this conversation. I'll be happy for that.
Oh. Well, we're delighted to have you. And,
oh, yes, absolutely.
And, Mom, do you have some closing words today?
Yes, I'm going to use one of the stanzas from this book on page 61. If what we love and do well helps others, that's our natural best work.
Thank you.
Great?
I believe that's great.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lawrence.
Thank you. And
my pleasure. I look forward to being able to hear what we actually said.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Oh, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.